I see ideas and stories everywhere, all the time. Everybody I talk to has something I want to write about, and it's hard to turn that off.
Have you ever read a story that's really blown you away? Something that makes you want to find out more about the story and what went into it? That happened to me this last week when I read Steve Freese's piece in the latest New Republic magazine. It's about a cache of letters written by one of the American liberators of the Dachau concentration camp during World War II. It's a powerful story, and Steve does a great job telling it. So I reached out to Steve and had a great conversation about long-form journalism. We also talk about another investigative piece he did on the broken sex offender registry system here in the U.S. Due to the nature of the subjects we talk about, this podcast isn't for everyone. But I do encourage you to give it a listen. It's an insightful discussion about some of the challenges journalists face when they're covering difficult subjects. Enjoy. Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. Today on the phone, I'm talking with Steve Freese, a freelance journalist who's written for Politico and the New York Times. He was also a Knight Wallace Fellow from 2011 to 2012 at the University of Michigan. Hi, Steve.
Oh, hi.
Yeah. Let's do that again. Hi, Steve.
You snuck up on me.
Hi, Steve. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. And you're in Michigan now?
I am. We live in Ann Arbor.
Oh, okay, cool. The reason we're talking is I came across this incredible story you wrote for the New Republic called A Liberator But Never Free. Would you mind sort of going through talking about what that story is about to sort of get us started?
Sure. The piece is a analysis, a look, a narrative based primarily off of hundreds of letters that a doctor named David Wilsey sent to his wife, Emily, during World War II. He was an anesthesiologist with the 116th Evacuation Hospital from about November of 1944 until the end of the war, and he actually was sort of stuck in Europe until the end of 45 because we kept troops and stuff there. He was a very commandeering and difficult person later in life. He was hard on his kids. He was somewhat humorless. He was very fastidious and strict and often demeaning to his children and his wife. But in these letters that were found in the attic of their home in like 2009, after both their father and mother died, the Wilsey children found this trunk, and inside the trunk were all these pieces of artifacts from his time in the war, and then also a cardboard box full of hundreds of letters from his father, from their father to their mother. These letters are incredibly well written. They are incredibly insightful. In many ways, they reflect in so many different aspects what it was like to live in these times. And also, he was a doctor on the team that basically followed the troops around during the Battle of the Bulge, just behind the lines, to nurse all of the injured folks across France and Germany. And then in May of 1945, 70 years ago this month, he was with the group that was on hand after the liberation of Dachau, the concentration camp. They're very descriptive. They reflect, in a lot of ways, a different version of what we think we know about the war and the people who fought it and the people who worked in it. And these letters actually do go all the way back into 1942, before he went into the service while he was still serving as a doctor at a practice in Elko, Nevada. So there's this huge sweep that I wasn't even able to sort of deal with in the piece, because the piece had to focus tightly on a narrative of specifically Dachau, and there was so much material.
Yeah, yeah. And because you had the perspective of the earlier letters, you actually were able in a way to see the, you know, how his experience in Dachau, arriving after the original liberators came, what he saw and experienced, how that sort of affected him and in the way he communicated with his wife. There was sort of a clear difference between the way he was before he went to the camp and the time that he was after.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting is that the family, in this case, there are three children. The oldest is Terry, Clarice is the middle daughter, and Sharon is the youngest. And they are all now in their 60s and 70s. None of them have children. Only one of them is married, Terry. And they always baffle over what their father was doing and why he was so angry or why he was, you know, so difficult, why he withheld so much of his love. And then when they found these letters in 2009 after their parents died, they read these letters and they were just like somebody else had written them. They were romantic and funny and sweet and often open-minded and sometimes very closed-minded. And so they didn't read them all. They read a few of them, and they realized they had something valuable, but I think in a lot of ways it was very painful for them. And so Clarice Wilde has had them in her home in Eugene, Oregon for several years. She's read a few of them. But what I found was, first of all, in trying to kind of understand if there was a way to look at this material and see an explanation for how this man went from the sort of optimistic, fun-loving fella that he seemed to be earlier to the man that he was known as by his children. And what I started realizing was that you can dip in and out of these letters. You can read one of them as an historical document. You can go directly to May 8th, 1945 and read his account of going into Dachau and whatever. And they're really interesting as historical documents. But if you read dozens of these letters in chronology over the course of several months or years, that's how you really get to know him, and that's how you're able to detect a shift in the way he is. And you see it very clearly the minute he starts writing from Dachau. He is just 10 times angrier, as you might expect. But angry and vituperous and just very critical of all kinds of folks, including people you wouldn't expect to be criticized, like the chaplain or even some of the patients who he says were not grateful enough. I mean, that's a crazy thing to say, but in the immersed environment he was in, there's something psychological that's happening. And then you see over the next several months that it never really goes away. It gets better. He lightens up a bit, but he never really gets past it.
Yeah, the experience was so profound, it sort of changed his worldview, I guess, is one way to say it. How did you find out about this?
I've actually been a longtime friend with the oldest son, Terry. And I know that, you know, people listening are like, oh, that's easy. It's easy to find a story when it falls into your lap. And I'm not saying it didn't fall into my lap. It certainly did. But Terry is the oldest son, and he lives in Las Vegas, where I lived for a long time. And I've known the family for a long time. And when they discovered these letters, at first I just thought they were a couple, and I thought maybe it would be an interesting feature of some sort. It wasn't until I went up to Eugene and actually saw that there were hundreds of them, and the quality of the writing and the historical nature of it, that I realized it was a much bigger and better story than I knew. But I certainly got good access because I knew the family already. But, you know, hey, sometimes the greatest stories are right in front of you and people don't see them.
Right. Well, and you being a journalist, I mean, it was pretty clear to you pretty quickly, probably, that once you saw all these letters, that there was some sort of story in here. How do you get your hands around something like this and create a narrative that you can, you know, turn around and publish somewhere?
You know, I really thought this was going to be a quickie. I thought, okay, there are these letters. You know, the letters will tell the story. There's this family. I didn't think it was going to be a hard thing to write, really. I thought it would be pretty simple. This is a reversal in a lot of ways of the type of long-form journalism that most of us normally do, which is intensive on reporting, and then the writing is important, but they're at least equal. In this case, the reporting was, well, I mean, there was only three people to interview. the yeah. children. And then there were these hundreds of letters to read. And I read them several times.
Yeah.
I went up to Eugene thinking I would read them there. Then I realized how many there were. So I decided I had to figure out how to sort of triage the story. I couldn't read hundreds of them. There would be no way to write a coherent narrative for a magazine that spanned the letters from 1942 all the way to 1946 and the immense volume of it. So I figured, okay, the story is going to be his experience at Dachau. At least that's going to be the most obvious part. And so we ran to Kinko's because Clarice Wilde would not let me take them home.
Sure.
We ran to Kinko's and we made copies, spent all day copying, getting me a set of letters that included all of April, May, and June of 1945, and then a smattering of others. And then I took them home and I spent weeks reading them and rereading them and pulling out sections that I thought were interesting and confusing myself by putting highlights on passages and then trying to figure out why I did that. And I just kind of kept working it until I could see what the story actually was. I mean, I knew the story was Dachau, but how did it connect to the family drama, the sort of the parallel drama that goes on many years later when the family's trying to figure out, the kids are trying to figure out, wait, who is this guy? So it was a matter of, I mean, it took a tremendous amount of time to read these. They're very well written. They're seductively written. They're, fortunately for a doctor, very good handwriting. And, but, you know, it just took a lot. And then I, you know, what I did do to sort of get perspective, because I had no idea if this stuff was unique or normal or standard, if things that he talked about that I'd never heard of were well known in the Holocaust history community. So I put together a 4,000 word document that contained excerpts of dozens of these letters that I thought represented what was going on here, his experiences, what he was saying. And then I put that in a Dropbox, and I showed it to a number of Holocaust experts of different types, linguists and Dachau experts and medical experts. And I tried to get a sense from them of what's interesting here. Because, I mean, it's all interesting to me, but I don't know if we already knew a lot of this stuff. And some of it we already knew, but it wasn't very well played up in the mainstream narrative of the end of the war.
Yeah, and I think some of the things that you're sort of alluding to are the sort of sense that a lot of the narrative that's out there about the American liberation of these camps is, in a certain way, has been sanitized. That these were human beings, these were soldiers who'd been through a lot, and then they were exposed to something that was, you know, certainly with this letter writer here, was completely mind altering, and they may not have behaved in the way that we would like to think that they would behave. And some of the stuff that you touch on, you talk about, his perception of other people, some things, perceptions that are racist, some things that may be more common in that time period. So we're looking at it, you know, across history. Sort of this part of the thing is when you bring in a personal narrative, you have to have all that other baggage that goes with it.
Right.
And it may not fit in with what, you know, the common narrative is and perception that people have. This is not to say that what he did, what other people did at these camps wasn't good and great and important. But it's just, you know, when you look at history, there's a lot more to it than just what's in the history books. You have real human beings dealing with really high pressure, crazy situations.
Well, you know, it's interesting because this is a piece that I think you can almost feel it is bulging with other angles or the desire for more background and more reporting than I was able to do in this particular amount of space, which was considerable. It was 5,000 words, which is not a bad amount. I asked for that. I didn't realize when I was writing that it would really could have used 10. And the problem with doing a 10,000 word piece like this is that the narrative, the story, the thread I'm trying to pull the reader through does get disconnected if you go off for too long on different tangents. But, for example, the thing you were talking about, he has a very shocking passage. He wrote a very shocking passage late in 1945 about his concerns. Basically, he's in Paris, the war is over, and he's concerned because he sees the continental women, the white European women, are having lots of sex, he says, with black soldiers. And he's worried that the black soldiers are going to go back to the U.S., thinking that all's better and they can go and have sex with white women and there's going to be lots of rape. And, I mean, it's a very disturbing interpretation. And in it, he also includes what was at the time some fairly common but now very shocking verbiage about, and remember, he's a medical doctor, and he's talking about to his wife about quote-unquote proven physiological differences between blacks and whites, or blacks and other races. And these are things that now have been long disproved, but we don't remember necessarily that one of the things that disproved it was the discovery of DNA and the ability to map genes and find out that we all have basically the same genes. So that's science that comes along years later. But it's important also because we look at the Nazis and we say, God, they were monsters. They were these eugenics nuts that were trying to, like, engineer things and find out, do all these horrible experiments to figure out differences between gypsies and Jews and whatever else there is. And here's a doctor who's there to liberate or there to help liberate one of these camps. And he kind of has opinions that are not quite as extreme, but they fall into the same category. And that's, I think, pretty historically important. I think it's very important to know that the smart people of the day, the educated people of that day, thought that way. The people of science thought that way at the time.
Right. The Nazism in a larger context did not spring out of nothing, that there were these beliefs and thoughts at that time in a lot of cultures, and certainly not to minimize the terrible things that happened during World War II. But the fact that you're able to, because it's like having a radio that you're communicating with somebody, you know, 60 years back, and they're talking to you in the way they would talk and expressing the thoughts that they would have at that time, that they don't have that intervening 60 years of cultural shift and change. It's an incredible window into a moment in history. But the fact is, and this is really what I like about this story a lot, and I think it was a very smart choice by you, is to sort of ground it in the narrative of today, of a family dealing with this, their connection with Dachau, and the father and the relationship with their father, and how they're sort of dealing with this thing that their father has left them. And you know, I thought that was the narrative that kind of, the string that kind of holds the whole thing together.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and what also is so interesting is that these are three rather different characters. I mean, if you're talking about them as characters, and I obviously have to, because for one thing, I kind of have become obsessed with this man and all of his very complicated elements. And so to me, obviously, I never met him. I know a lot about him from people I met, but I've never met him. And so reading these letters, I really liked him, and I wanted to, you know, it was almost one of those stories where you're thinking to yourself, gosh, I hope it works out well, and then you know it kind of doesn't. And it's kind of a bummer, but he didn't know it at the time. His wife didn't know it at the time. They didn't know anything at the time. And so it is this sort of time travel sort of thing. But what I was going to say was that they're three very different characters. The children, Terry, the oldest, and, you know, this is one of the reasons why this story very easily could have gone right on by me, was because he, honest to goodness, does not care. It is actually a fascinatingly weird reaction. He's 71 years old, and he seems to have disassociated with his father in a very unusual way. And this is not a dumb guy. This is a guy who is fascinated in everything. He's been a political activist. He's very well-read and well-educated. And he loves going to museums. He knows all this stuff, right? And so when I sit across from him at dinner one night and I say to him, you know, these letters are going to be used by historians in books. They're going to be in museums. And he looks at me and he's like, really? And then he moves on to the next topic. It's like, wait, that's kind of important. So he doesn't care. Clarice is incredibly immersed in it. Sharon is a little bit more removed as the youngest child. And so, you know, they have these very different reactions that have a difference in their own rooted in their own lives. And so that was kind of cool. They're not a united front in any particular way related to how they respond to this material.
Yeah. I thought that was, and you were very respectful, I think, to their stories and their perspectives. I don't think you glossed over anything. It was very, very plain and, you know, very honest about the way, you know, they react and just, you know, this is family stuff. This is, you come in and you're writing the story and you have this outsider's perspective, but they were living in this family. And so their experience is very different. So having it somehow linked to their father and their perceptions and their relationship with their father is certainly going to change their perspective on how these things work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a very tricky thing because I don't have access to these letters unless the family gives it to me.
Right.
And the family, the daughters, they're not terribly interested in their father being painted a monster. Whether or not he was, they're in a retrospective point that he's been dead for 20 years, and they're not terribly, you know, they want him to be seen as this great hero. And to my mind, what makes the story interesting is that he was, in a lot of ways, both. I mean, there's no doubt he was a hero. He was an incredibly heroic figure during that war. The things that he did, the honors he received, the people he saved, absolutely. This is a harrowing period in our history, and he performed brilliantly. And it cost him. That's the point. It cost him and his family a lot that they may or may not have ever known. He didn't want to talk about the Dachau during his lifetime. He didn't want to talk about World War II at all. And one of the things I figured out is that there are two different types of World War II veterans, right? They're the ones that that simply don't want to talk about it, and they're the ones who won't shut up about it. And they're both interesting psychological figures. What's fascinating about him is that he wrote these letters, so he did talk about it one time, back when it was happening, and pretty much never again. They didn't destroy the letters, so obviously they had some sense that they wanted them to be used someday, I think. That's my interpretation. But also, in the letters, particularly in May and June of 45, he repeatedly talks about how important it is that the public know what he's seeing. That his, you know, he tries to get his wife to, or I don't know what he specifically expects her to do, but he tries to get her to talk about what he saw and tell people, and he's terrified that the world won't believe what he has seen, which is an ongoing theme of the history of the Holocaust. So he had a motivation to get the word out. He just didn't do it in his life.
And you also mentioned in the narrative the story where, and I assume this is information that you've got from speaking to his children, that there were instances where he would see somebody on the news or talking about,
yeah,
you know, Holocaust deniers, and that would sort of spark him to a degree of, you know, that person's crazy, this stuff needs to be told. But that didn't necessarily mean that he was going to come out and talk about it.
Right. And I don't know how he thought it through. I don't know if he felt like, oh, okay, well, other people are doing it, I don't have to, or I just can't bear this. I mean, there's a difference between going out and having a press conference and simply telling your children about your experiences, and he did neither.
Well, and maybe he decided this was something so profound that he needed to distance himself just so that he could live his life. I don't know.
Right.
It was incredible, and we could talk about this the whole time. But I also want to talk about another story that you recently wrote. The other big recent investigative piece that you did was on the state of the sex offender registries across the U.S. You wrote a piece for TakePart.com. You also wrote a corresponding piece for Huffington Post. Can you talk sort of about that story a little bit?
Sure. I had been contacted a number of years ago. I was still living in Las Vegas, where I freelanced for a long time, by a fella who wanted me to take a look at the sex offender registry listing for Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson, notably the most famous sex offender in the United States. He was convicted of rape in 1992 in Indiana. And the implication was that there was something fishy going on with his registry. And perhaps, in my mind, maybe there's a story here, like, you know, some quick celebrity-type story about Mike Tyson not registering properly. Because he lived in Henderson, Nevada, which is just outside of Las Vegas. But what this fellow was trying to show me, and his name is Tim Fisher. Tim Fisher was trying to show me that the registry is not a registry. It is many registries, and they are often in great deal of conflict with one another. And as a result, people who are victims of sex offenses can have a really hard time if they go to the registry trying to figure out where their offender is and whether he's alive or dead or in jail or not or on the run or whatever. And the point was that Mike Tyson was, at that time, this is 2009, I guess, Mike Tyson was considered to be non-compliant by the state of Nevada's sex offender registry. Mm-hmm. But the city of Henderson has one too, and he was perfectly properly registered there. He also was nowhere to be found in the registry of Indiana, where he was convicted. He was in the registry in Florida, where he had lived, but that registration said he lived in Arizona. Arizona had no reference for him at all, and so on. And it was just this big sort of, you know, mess. And this was one example of somebody who you and I could find out where he is tomorrow just by looking him up on Twitter. So the idea that there are thousands and thousands, about 800,000 people in various registries in the United States across the country, and there's no indication of whether those registries are accurate, it seemed like a very different story to me than the one we often see, which is the register stories about, you know, somebody who commits a crime after they've been on the registry, or somebody who can't find a place to live because the registry is so restrictive that the locations where they can live are uninhabitable. We see stories from social scientists about whether registries actually help or hurt in terms of minimizing recidivism or giving people tools. But what I never saw a story on was, is this information even right? And how wrong is it? And the answer is extremely wrong. And everybody who runs these registries, the registries of the various states and local localities, they know it. They know that there's a certain margin of error here. And the margin of error in many cases is pretty large, although without being able to get into the documents, you know, firsthand, there's no way I can assess exactly how big the problem is. But it's certainly big enough that it doesn't take much if anybody wants to go online, look up a list of noncompliant sex offenders on some state registry, because they always have sort of a section for that, and then do a bit of Googling, and often you can easily find out where these people are. And that's on the one hand is nice, you can do it, but that's not the purpose of the concept. The concept is to be able to track these people, know where they are, have them up to date, and there is no real unifying organization. There's a federal website that's basically just like a pointer system to the various state websites. Those state websites may or may not be in some sort of concert with local registries that are put up by counties or cities or local police departments. It's a technological mess, and it was a very difficult story to explain to editors and explain how I would go about it to editors. And so it took me 5 years to get that story assigned. It was really hard.
So did you do any reporting before you tried to get it to or look for an assignment for it, or, you know, how did that work for you?
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, the reporting I needed to do at least in early going was to see if I could find mistakes myself. If that was the case, then that seemed to be a pretty significant problem. I didn't really go too much deeper at that point because I really wanted an editor with whom I could talk about exactly how you go about a story like this. I wasn't sure if this was a story about a technology failure or a governmental policy failure, or just the fact that there's what ultimately I realized, having worked with a very good editor and having thought about it, having been forced by a lot of different editors to rethink how I was pitching the story, to come to realize that there was a central narrative, which is the journey of this one sex offender victim, Tim Fisher, his very lonely effort to get attention for this problem. And then from there, I could go on and explain what the problem is in the technology and follow him in some narrative way. It took a long time to figure that out. I realize now it's sort of obvious. At the time, I was thinking, well, maybe we get a team of people together and we go through, you know, the registries of every state. I mean, I had these huge, broad ideas that were probably much too ambitious and probably never going to be statistically sound anyway.
How difficult was it for you to sell this story?
It was one of the most difficult stories I've ever had to sell. There was, I passed this pitch on to so many editors over years. You know, I interrupted by the fact that I had a fellowship at University of Michigan, and then I spent a year working full-time at Politico. So when I came back to freelancing after that in 2013, I resurrected it and tried to figure out, okay, is there anything that can be done with this? Is the story still the same as it was back, you know, several years ago? You know, it's one of those stories that gosh, you know, I really don't know. It's just one of those things I couldn't let go of. And when Take Part was willing to take it, I was just so excited. I mean, there had been a couple of occasions where there were other editors that had taken an interest in the idea. And it started actually with ProPublica. I mean, I was at a freelancer summit at Stanford University, I think right after I learned about this story, and I went right up and cold pitched a woman from ProPublica who was really, really interested. And then when I followed up with her, she eventually decided they didn't want to fund the story. And nobody really ever gave me a good answer for it, just sort of that they had other things they wanted to spend their money on. And maybe it was that I didn't have a clearly focused pitch that didn't narrow in on exactly what the architecture of the story would be. And that's important. I mean, at least an editor, particularly one that you've never worked with before, needs to have a sense that you're capable of finding the thread and bringing the reader through the story. And maybe back at that point in time, I didn't. I often wonder about it, but at the same time, you know, ultimately I found an editor that was willing to let me do it the way I wanted to do it. And that way that I wanted to do it wasn't really exactly mapped out even in my own mind. So I got lucky in terms of finding some place to do it, and I'm happy I did.
Did you find it kind of strange that both of these stories, they center on a very personal story that's kind of at the center of it, that anchors it, and that you're telling a bigger story around it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm learning this craft along the way. I mean, I want to write pieces that have broader substance to them. And I mean, I did a lot of celebrity journalism profiles, and I love doing that stuff. And certainly I do a lot of you know, news features in the 1,000 to 2,000 word range for, you know, The Times or Bloomberg Politics or whoever. And so those are easier stories. The problem is that there is a potential, if you find yourself having to focus on a particular person or specific narrative, there is a potential that maybe you minimize the more serious elements of the story. And that often worries me. You know, I was concerned for a long time about focusing so much on Tim for a couple of reasons. One is that, yes, he is a heroic lone wolf activist, and that's interesting, although the fact is that because he was a lone wolf activist, there were a lot of editors who didn't think he was for real. They thought he was a crackpot. They thought that you know, surely if this was really that big a problem, you know, the Adam Walshes of the world would be taking it on, and they don't. So there's sort of that bias against the people you haven't heard of or the organizations you'd never heard of before. That exists out there. That's hard when you're talking to editors. But also, he's also somebody who his sex offender, his rapist, was convicted and put in prison, and not for very long, but he went to prison and has been on this sex offender registry for decades and has always been properly listed and properly registered. So how do you make a narrative out of somebody who for whom the system is actually working when you're trying to point out the system's not working? And maybe if Mike Tyson wanted to hang out with me and talk about it, he could have been the central narrative, but only if it had caused him problems in his life, and so far as I can tell, it has not. It was just a really tricky piece. There's another piece that I actually did, and it ended up at Al Jazeera Long Form last fall, but it was a similar kind of thing where I was fascinated by the fallout that occurred in New Jersey after Hurricane Sandy hit, or Superstorm Sandy hit, and the governor decided to allow everybody in New Jersey to vote by email, vote by the internet in the 2012 election. Nobody had really examined, but I had been at Politico at the time and saw how disastrous it was, what a mess it was, and in particular the fact that all the technology geeks, the people who are always telling us, yeah, we can do anything, they're the ones who are standing up first to say, no, you don't vote by the internet. It's terrible. It's unsafe. It's awful. I mean, these are the guys saying it's not possible, or it's not possible with the internet as it's configured now. And that, I thought, was a huge story and a really interesting way to look at it. But again, I wasn't able to find a specific narrative that satisfied certain editors. And ultimately, the story ended up being shorter and not as propulsive or important as I had hoped.
What's been the response to these two stories that you did, the sex offender one and also the Dachau letter one?
The Dachau one's been huge, and in fact, you know, I've heard from a number of different quarters about, you know, other stories about found treasures of World War II and things like that. I mean, once you do a story like this, people see it and they're like, oh wow, maybe this is how Dad's stuff can get out into the world. And so there's been a lot of internet traffic and a lot of very, very good response. Of course, it's funny to me because I read the story and I know what's missing.
Uh-huh.
You know, I know what we had to cut and what kills me that we had to cut. And, you know, and a lot of it, I can't even explain why we cut it other than that we had this much space and something had to go. And so, you know, it's hard for me to reread that piece because I just see all the things I wanted in there that aren't there, which is, you know, that's, I think, probably normal. The sex offender piece, I was a little disappointed by, and that's why I went on to do the Huffington Post piece as well, because there are a lot of elements of that story that could have been easily picked up by local media. We had a map that showed at least one sex offender error in almost every state. So, you know, local TV stations could have easily picked up on it. There also was the fact that this material is used by the media. I mean, the sex offender registry, particularly the television media, particularly the local TV media, during sweeps, which we were just in May, they use them all the time to sort of, you know, scare viewers into watching. You know, is there a pervert on your street? That's a very common story that these local TV stations do, and they use the sex offender registry because essentially the sex offender registry being sort of blessed by the government is this like ultimate version of police fed. You know, they don't local journalists don't feel like they have to check anything out because this is like almost like a massive press release from the police department. But if they look carefully, they'd find out that there are people who are on the list who shouldn't be, that they're unnecessarily scaring people, that there are addresses that are on the list that shouldn't be, that they're putting people in danger because they're people who live in these houses that were once rented by sex offenders, and people in the neighborhood will look it up, see that, and think that the people who are living there now are sex offenders and all of the problems that creates, including vigilante violence. So there were a lot of, like, other ways to go with this. I was really surprised that some of the other journalism blogs and programs weren't interested in this kind of fundamental problem. The government's giving us this massive bunch of data that's not right.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's hard to believe anymore. I mean, maybe in 2009 it was, but now we've had the IRS thing and the VA records and the Obamacare website, and it's not that unusual to think that the government is kind of lousy at database procurement and technology. They're not good at this type of thing, and yet it's an amazingly important thing that they're handling.
Yeah, yeah. Clearly, it's a problem that needs to be solved. So there was no heat that came off of that, no interest by any politicians or any other journalism outlets at all.
Not that I saw, no.
Yeah, that's a shame because there was a lot in there. Now, both the letter story and the sex offender register story sort of reveal truths that are counter to the commonly held perceptions. Are these kind of the types of stories you like to do?
Yeah, I've for a long time I've had a very broad sort of random range of things I'm interested in. I have done a number of these types of stories. I did a long piece that won a number of awards a few years ago about a woman named Christine Daniels. She was a transgender sports writer for the LA Times. Her born name was Mike Penner. She transitioned to be Christine Daniels with a great deal of fanfare. Then, with very little fanfare, she retreated to being Mike Penner, and then she killed herself. And it was a really intense, long, traumatic story about this thing that's now become much more common to talk about, the whole transgender experience, and this idea of regretting the transition and what it means to be transgender in the public eye. And that was for the LA Weekly. And I also did another big piece for Take Part on male victims of sexual assault in the military. And right now I'm working on another piece for the New Republic about another case that has to do with sexual assault of male victims in the military. And so, yeah, I guess there is something about the issues of sex and gender and sexuality that have always fascinated me. And that, in some cases, the best way to tell the story is to really try to give the reader a sense that they know the person that they're reading about easier. You know, you can read a lot of news accounts, you know, wire type stories about, you know, so and so does this, so and so does that. But of course, what's great about long form is you do get an opportunity to spend more time with somebody, and as a writer and as a reader.
Are you primarily doing long form now, or are you sort of mixing it up with other assignments?
I've been mixing it up. I've got a couple of pieces I'm working on right now for Al Jazeera America, business piece for the New York Times business section. I've been covering the Supreme Court process related to same-sex marriage for Al Jazeera America for the last several years. I think I've learned how to settle down and pay attention to one topic for a longer period of time. I have trained myself to not be so ADD about my work, to not get to Friday and think, oh, my God, I didn't file anything this week. What a loser. and also to look around the world and say, okay, yes, that's a cool story, but I'm probably not going to get very much money for it. It'll probably take some of my time, and I guess I just can't do every last thing that occurs to me. Yeah. I see ideas and stories everywhere, all the time. Everybody I talk to has something I want to write about, and it's hard to turn that off.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're journalists. We're supposed to be curious people, and when things interest us, and we see a narrative, we want to run after it. How can people find your work and find out more about you?
Well, I just pulled down my website because it was 14 years old and needed to be overhauled. So I just pulled it down. The website would be my name, stevefreese.com, when it gets back up and running. But for the moment, I guess mostly Twitter is fine, which is just at stevefreese on Twitter. And yeah, that's pretty much, all my email addresses on my Twitter profile. I will have a better site soon. I'm paying a lot of money for it, so it's going to be good. And that was sort of the thing where, like, the first site I did primarily by myself, and that was 2001 when, it was kind of new and it was cool. But now, you know, I've been kind of embarrassed by it for a while, and so it's time to take it down and get and actually pay somebody so that you get what you want for it.
Yeah, Grandpa, take your website down.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because I also, for many, many years, because I didn't have a full-time job anywhere, and I would just use my AOL address. I liked AOL. I was comfortable with it, but I was always getting, you know, funny looks and mockery for it, which I don't understand because email is email. I don't get why anybody cares which email people use. But nonetheless, that was a thing, and it made me look somehow less professional. And so when I got my job when I got the fellowship at the University of Michigan, I said, okay, well, rather than think I'm like some ancient, you know, relic of the 90s, they'll think I'm a professor. And that's not true anymore. I was teaching at MSU, but I haven't been teaching for a while. But I'm not saying that. I'm just using the email, so I'm not really deceiving anybody.
Okay. All right. Well, and look at the, you know, I'm going to have links to the stories we talked about on our website. But, you know, definitely if you listen to this podcast, you don't go to my website, you know, go to New Republic, Google Steve Freese and read this story. It's pretty amazing, the Dachau letter story. Thanks for spending some time with me. This has been a really great conversation.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.